my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Well, I hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and I go, the seconds tick, the time out. There's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Ooh. Cat Stevens singing On the Road to Find Out. Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. We are now streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the listen button. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and underwriters like yourselves. So once again, go to kkrn.org and click on the donate button to support our efforts. Unspun is normally a call-in show. Today's show is pre-recorded, and so therefore you will not be able to call in. So if you do want to contact me, you can also send me email at unspun@kkrn.org, or you can follow me at on Twitter at DougBennett15 on Twitter. On the phone from Germany is our guest, Ernst Wolf. Ernst Wolf is a freelance journalist and author of the book Pillaging the World, The History of Politics, no, The History and Politics of the IMF. Ernst was born in 1950 in Tianjin, China, spent his childhood in Seoul, Korea, went to school in Germany, and spent his freshman year in the U.S. attending Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. He has worked in several professions, mostly as a screenplay writer for the German and Swiss television. He has researched and written on the interrelationship between economics and politics for 40 years and is convinced that we are reaching a critical time for the world. Quote, Ernst says, "The financial crisis of 2007/2008 has only been the harbinger of a global financial tsunami in which the IMF and its allies will resort to measures the likes of which we cannot even imagine." Ernst Wolf, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, good to have you. We tried last week.
Right. We weren't very successful.
Well, the phone system was working against us, I think, but I'm so glad to have you on now. You've done a lot of research and a lot of writing and thinking about a subject I think is just so very important to everybody in the world. Most Americans don't know. Just literally don't know. We're pretty ignorant of history in general, and we are also very ignorant of the financial world that you've done so much research in. I've watched you on RT television and in a couple of debates with some of the others over there in Europe, you know, debating what's going on. And I was thinking that your work in looking into the history of the IMF is so very important in your book, Pillaging the World, The History and Politics of the IMF. So maybe we can start and give our listeners kind of a recap of IMF history, where it started, what were the actual functions of the IMF. And if we can start there, and then we'll just move from there and come up to all the critical problems that are going on in Europe at the moment, and not only in Europe, around the world. So if you want to start there, maybe a little quick history of the IMF for our listeners.
Okay, yes. Well, the history of the IMF dates back to the end of the Second World War. The Second World War sort of changed the face of the world. Before the Second World War was the British Empire that actually ruled the world. And with the Second World War, the domination of the world by the United States began. The United States, by the end of the Second World War, was the economically most powerful nation on Earth. It was the militarily most powerful nation on Earth. It was the only nation that had the nuclear bomb. And also the U.S. held two-thirds of the world's gold reserves then. So what they their problem at that time was that they had a big problem with their overproduction. They were producing more goods than their own markets could absorb. So they looked for a way out of that. And to that end, they called for a conference at the small place called Bretton Woods in New Hampshire. They invited 44 other nations to come and join them. And then they created a new financial and monetary system for the whole world that was very unique. It placed one currency, the U.S. dollar, at in the position of the leading currency of the world. That had never before then been the case. So they introduced a new monetary system with a dollar as the leading currency for the world. That, of course, gave the Americans a very big advantage over the rest of the world. They could export their goods into the most removed countries on Earth and be sure that they would be paid in dollars. This system lasted until about beginning of the 1970s. At the end of the 60s, a lot of nations and a lot of individual investors became kind of suspicious if the system would hold, and a lot of people started to change their dollars into gold. And so the gold reserves in the United States started to dwindle. And then President Nixon, closed the gold window in 1971, and that would actually have been the end of the dollar as the leading currency in the world. But then Nixon and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, came up with a very clever idea. They went to Saudi Arabia and told the Saudi Arabian monarch, one of the most backward monarchs in the world, a guy who beheads people, who stones people, they told him that they would keep him in power if he guaranteed them that all oil trade by Saudi Arabia would only be conducted in dollars. And Saudi Arabia agreed to that, and so Saudi Arabia, which was at that time the biggest oil exporter in the world, went to the OPEC, the Organization of Petrol Exporting Countries, and made all other countries join them. And from then on, oil was only traded in U.S. dollars. Oil is the most important commodity in the world. It's the most widely traded commodity in the world. And by instituting this kind of dollar trade in oil, the petrodollar was founded. So from then on, every nation on Earth had to keep dollar reserves in order to be able to pay for energy, for oil. So that way, the dollar became the most widely spread reserve currency in the world. And that, of course, makes its power until today. And that, of course, is also the backing for the IMF. The IMF in the beginning was only instituted to promote the stability of the new system which made the dollar the leading currency of the world. But it became there were other tasks waiting for it. In the 1960s, for example, a lot of African states became independent, and they had to find their place in the world economy. And no banks were ready to loan them give them loans because of the instability of their countries. And so the IMF stepped in as the lender of last resort, gave them loans, and tied these loans to conditions. And by these conditions, the United States were able to influence the politics of these countries. And that has lasted to this day.
Yeah, they did the same thing in South America, wreaking havoc there. It's interesting that you brought up that three criminals, Nixon, Kissinger, and the Saudi dictator, got together and made that deal that's influencing the whole world. Truman, in my studies, I found that so many things started with Truman's administration. He, consolidated. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry. You cut out a little bit there. Go ahead.
I mean, Truman was the only president that threw nuclear bombs on civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right?
Yeah, and we're so worried about Iran, a country that has not attacked anybody in, 600 years. Which brings me to, coming up to date a little bit, and a curious thing about how all of this happened. I wonder why so many other nations were seeing the consequences of this kind of neoliberal hegemonic behavior around the world now. And why do so many countries tolerate this behavior by the United States? And is that changing?
I don't think it's changing. It's not really a conflict between the United States and the different countries. Actually, it's the financial industry that dominates the whole world, and the financial industry has power over all governments in the world. I mean, you do not become elected as president of any country in this world without being a servant of the financial industry. So they all actually do work together. Of course, they have conflicting interests in this and that respect, but basically, deep down, when it gets to the nitty-gritty, they all work for the financial industry.
Yeah, I stand corrected. I had forgotten that they're really, and they're running the United States too, of course. Yes,
it is running the White House.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And we have basically a corporate government in the U.S. now, right down to the Supreme Court justices. One of my favorite pictures shows the Supreme Court justices with all the logos of the corporations on their judicial robes. So this, which I consider corruption, because if that's the case, then democracy does not exist anymore.
No, definitely not. No, I mean, they allow as much democracy as they can take. I mean, they allow for people to criticize them every now and then, but once these people become really serious and there's a threat to the domination of the world by the financial industry, that's when they get serious, and that's when they send in their troops and when they establish dictatorships.
That's true, because and that's been I don't know if you're familiar with the work of John Perkins, but he what was the name of his book? Can't remember it right now, but in that he was an agent basically for the economic corporate governance that would go around and offer to bribe dictators in all these countries, and then of course if they didn't take the bribe and they tried to hold out, then of course we sent in the military and removed them. We've seen that scenario over and over again in the United States, using their military might that way. Well, let's move.
Yeah, go ahead. In 1976 in Argentina.
Yeah.
In 1970, Chile, yeah. The IMF became very active. I mean, that's when the IMF actually adopted the ideology of neoliberalism. That was when Pinochet killed thousands of students and came to power. And he asked the CIA and Henry Kissinger for help, and they sent him Milton Friedman's Chicago Boys as the advocates of neoliberalism. And they introduced measures which are these days known as austerity measures, which we can see in Greece, for example, which we've seen in Ireland, which we've seen in Spain and in Italy. And that shows that the IMF is ready to help install dictatorships all over the world.
Yeah, Pinochet was a notorious dictator and was a bloody coup promoted by the U.S. and I think killed Salvador Allende in the process. So more criminal behavior.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course when
three years later, yeah. China. It was Videla. It was General Videla who also killed about 30,000 people coming to power in a very bloody coup, and he also was supported by the U.S. The measures that were adopted economically were all dictated by the IMF.
And let me remind
the IMF
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment of truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Ernst Wolf, freelance journalist and author of Pillaging the World, the History and Politics of the IMF. And we're discussing the economic crisis in Europe and around the world and what this economic hegemonic system that we live in, what that means for all of us right now and in the future. And we're not taking any calls today. Today's show is pre-recorded. Well, let's come back to a current example of how this is working. Maybe you can explain to people. We're looking at Greece now literally fighting for its life as a nation and a people. And Americans really don't know what's going on there. They think the Greek are just fat and happy and lazy, and they borrow money, and now they're in trouble, and they got to pay their debts, and they're whining. And so maybe you could explain to Americans, what's actually happened in Greece?
Yeah, sure. Greece was hit hard by the euro crisis, and the euro crisis, of course, was nothing but the kind of extension of the subprime mortgage crisis in the U.S. A lot of banks in all over Europe engaged in very heavy speculation and the subprime market in the U.S., and when that bubble burst, a lot of big banks went under in all over Europe. And the Greek banks went under, and they, just like all the other banks, had to be saved by the state. So that ripped big holes into the state budget. And then, in order to fill these holes again, the Troika was established. The Troika consists of the European Central Bank, the European Union, and the International Monetary Fund. And these three organizations organized a huge orgy of theft because the debts that had been incurred by the investors, by rich people, by the ultra-rich, by the banks, had to be repaid by the working people. For this, they implemented austerity programs. And Greece, to this date, has seen six rounds of austerity programs. The details of these austerity programs look like this. Old age pensions are cut. People in the public service are laid off. Teachers and the public servants are paid less than before. The medical system in Greece has been taken down. Their budget is now less than half what it was 4 years ago. Kids do not get vaccinated in Greece anymore because nobody can pay for it. Women that are pregnant cannot have their babies in hospitals anymore because they have to pay for it. So what the Troika has been doing, the Troika has been implementing measures to make working people pay for the sins of the bankers in their orgy of speculation. And what we're seeing right now is that a new Greek government has been elected, which has promised its people to end austerity. But the problem is that the Troika is insisting on every single one of its measures. So we're actually heading for a clash there.
Well, it's like taking Greece and the Greek people back to the Stone Ages. It sounds like that they've basically destroyed the Greek society in a sense, or at least reduced it to something, pre-modern or whatever you want to call it. I'm just amazed. And now the Greek people are fighting back, I understand. So what do you think what's going to play out here with the new government and who's the prime minister? It's Tsipras, I believe. How is this going to play out? I know it's like a scenario here that's playing out with the Troika, and Germany has some role in that. I'm not exactly sure what that role is, and maybe you can tell us, how do you think this is going to play out?
Well, of course, Germany is part of the Troika because Germany is part of the European Union. Germany actually is the strongest economy in the European Union. And contrary to what people, what the mainstream media here in Europe tell people, the European Union was never founded for to establish peace and a wonderful life here in Europe. But the EU is actually an organization that represents the interests of big finance capital in Europe and the big corporations. And Germany was one of the nations in Europe that were really keen on introducing the euro, which was introduced in 2001. Until then, the different countries in Europe had different currencies. And this currency, the euro, has really helped Germany, because before that they had the Deutschmark. And Germany has a very, very strong export economy. And because of that strong economy, it was always under pressure to reevaluate the Deutschmark. But ever since they joined the euro, and ever since very weak nations joined the euro, the currency has continually weakened, which actually helps German exports because they get cheaper. So the German export industry is flourishing. So what the Germans want, they want to keep Greece within the euro, but at the same time, the big corporations and the banks do not want to pay for their sins themselves. They want the Greek people to pay for it. So Germany is one of the leading actors in implementing austerity measures on Greece, just like on all the other countries, like Spain and Portugal and Ireland. That's the role of the Germans. The Germans are the strongest within the EU, and they're very interested in keeping up the euro and keeping to profit from it. But at the same time, of course, this causes a lot of discontent. So that's why you see a lot of people in Greece these days demonstrating and showing swastikas and calling the Chancellor Merkel a fascist.
So do you think they're going to win out? I think Iceland is really the poster child for what most of these nations should be. I don't know if you're familiar with what happened in Iceland, but they arrested the bankers and they said, no, we're not paying this. It's an illegal debt and we're simply not paying it and let it default or whatever happened there. And they restored their economy in a number of months. I don't understand why more people in the Eurozone there don't take the same actions. Why not?
Iceland was not part of the euro.
Mm-hmm.
They had currency, and now we're dealing with all these countries that have the common currency of the euro, and that is, of course, that is their problem, because they cannot leave the eurozone. That is absolutely impossible, because all these countries are hugely indebted. I mean, Greece, for example, has a debt amounting to 320 billion euros. And all this debt these days is insured in the derivative markets. So if Greece actually defaulted, derivatives would come due that would make up a sum total of about $2 to $3 trillion. And that would take down the whole financial system, the global financial system. So they cannot allow any country to leave the euro. That is absolutely impossible because of the derivative market. You know that the financial industry nowadays is much, much bigger than the real economy. Until the 1970s or so, you had the real economy that was the dominant factor in economics. But then they started with deregulation, and they started with liberalization and so on, and the banks became more powerful. And then in the 1990s, the banks started with the derivatives, and one of the most important derivatives is the credit default swaps. And these credit default swaps have been sold at an amazing rate. And nowadays, in 2010, I think it was, the derivative market itself was about seven times the amount of the size of the real economy. So you can see from that the financial industry is actually dominating the real economy and is dominating the world. And so if any country within the euro would default, it would take down the euro, and that would take down the dollar, and that would take down the whole world financial system.
Well, it seems like something has to give here. It seems insane to me to have the derivative market be the backup for your debt. That's like That's like gambling. It's a ghost. It's not real asset. So how can it be backing for debt at all? And so what about the chance of forgiving? Most of this debt is simply on paper. What about the chance of just simply, or not even on paper anymore? It's somewhere. It's just digits in some computer server somewhere. But why doesn't the rest of the Eurozone realize that you're going to have to forgive this debt somehow?
But that's not what ultra-rich people do. They don't forgive. You know, they want more and more and more. They even fight wars in order not to forgive debt.
Well, the Greek people cannot go on. I mean, what else is left to give? They're giving their lives, even some of them at this point, since you've wiped out the Troika has basically wiped out their health system, so people now are dying for this debt.
That is very true. And there's at the moment, I don't really see a way out of that, because you see the new government, the Syriza government, has met with a lot of resistance from the Troika, and the Troika has not shown any willingness to back down on its demands. I mean, the Syriza government, for example, they wanted to raise the minimum wage, and the Troika said no. And they wanted to raise pensions, and the Troika said no. Or take a look at Ukraine. Yesterday in Ukraine, old age pensions were lowered in order to fill the holes in the state budget. They were lowered at the order of the IMF and the Troika. So they don't care. If people die, they don't care if people get killed, if people commit suicide. They only care about collecting. That's what the IMF and the Troika are. They're big debt-collecting agencies.
And debt-creating also.
Debt-creating, yeah. And then debt-collecting, yeah.
Yeah.
They're luring countries into the debt trap, and once they're in there, they're acting as a debt-collecting agency.
And an enforcer of conditions that people can't meet.
Exactly. And that's why we're entering a new period in history here in Europe, because this is not going to end in peace, and this is going to end in revolution. I'm betting on revolutions taking place in Europe within the next 5 years, because people just cannot live under these conditions anymore.
Well, and the failed, it's obvious that it's a failed financial system. It's a Ponzi scheme house of cards that can't possibly go on much longer. People all over the world, I think, are starting to realize this. Like I say, Americans are a little more ignorant, I think, than people in Europe and other nations, because they simply too busy being entertained and distracted with nonsense, while this monster financial system is sitting on Americans' backs too. Because, as you say, once one of the cards goes, then the whole house of cards collapses. And I think that's one reason I wanted to have you on the show, because I think it's so important that Americans get it, because, I mean, we still have a little bit of financial strength in America. But if we don't reel in the financial system, which many of the members of that financial system are based out of the U.S., where we originally stopped the deregulation against all good sense. We have to thank Bill Clinton for some of that. A lot of people think Bill Clinton was just wonderful, other than his little affairs. But they don't realize he's the one that opened the door to a lot of that neoliberal. And now I look
at... Definitely, he abolished the Glass-Steagall Act, which was very important for the derivatives. In 1999, you know, you had the separation between the investment banks and the normal banks. And he actually abolished that. So that's when these real big orgies of speculation actually started.
Yeah, it runs throughout our history. Only people don't realize it. Like you say, it started back at Bretton Woods. What was that, 1944, before the end of the Second World War. Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Ernst Wolf, freelance journalist and author of Pillaging the World, The History and Politics of the IMF. And we're discussing world economics and the crisis in Europe, and what that means for all of us. Today's show is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking any calls in the studio. Coming back, you mentioned Ukraine, and I think this is another poster child for IMF, European Union intervention that has just destroyed Ukraine now as a country. Maybe you could bring our listeners up to date of what's happened in Ukraine and how that is playing out and what the IMF's role is there.
Okay, yes. Well, you have to see the Ukraine conflict in its geopolitical context. I told you about the petrodollar. The petrodollar is one of the pillars of U.S. dollar's domination of the world, and it's one of the most, one of the biggest assets that the IMF also has as the financial executive arm of Wall Street. The petrodollar was challenged several times. The first one to challenge the petrodollar was Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein started selling oil in euros, and that was his death sentence. The Iraq war was actually started because Saddam Hussein did this, and we all know how he ended. A short time later, it was Muammar al-Gaddafi. He wanted to sell his oil in euros, and also he wanted to set up an African currency which was tied to gold, which would also have threatened the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the financial system. So we know how he ended. And then last year, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, and the Chinese president concluded a deal, a huge energy deal, about natural gas and oil, which will run until 2026, and which was not, the deal was not concluded in dollars, in U.S. dollars. So it was kind of an affront to the petrodollar. And ever since, the Americans have pursued a policy of regime change in Russia. They want Putin removed. And that's why they are so active in Ukraine, because Ukraine is on the western border of Russia. All the other nations around Russia on the western border have in the meantime joined NATO, except for Ukraine. A lot of these other nations are also members of the European Union now, except for Ukraine. So the European Union is, of course, interested in getting the Ukraine into its own organization, because they have vast fields of wheat there. The country is very interesting because they have great reserves of natural gas, and of course they have the lowest minimum wage all over Europe. The minimum wage in Ukraine at the moment is $40 a month, and those are well-educated people. So the European Union is very interested in getting its hands on the Ukraine. The Americans, on the other hand, want the Ukraine within NATO, and that's why they have been furthering civil unrest in Ukraine for so long. I mean, Victoria Nuland once admitted that the Americans had already invested $5 billion in furthering social unrest in Ukraine. The government of Ukraine now, under Mr. Yatsenyuk, is nothing but a puppet regime of the White House. Their finance minister is actually a citizen of the United States and was only naturalized on the day she became finance minister of Ukraine. But you always have to see this as a part of the big geopolitical game. And the big geopolitical game at the moment is that the Americans want a regime change in Russia. And that's why they're doing that's why they even want to send arms into Ukraine, because they want to stir up trouble there, so in order to destabilize Putin's regime. That's their objective. And the IMF comes in. The IMF comes in because Ukraine at the moment is totally bankrupt. They do not have any money left to pay their bills, but they have to pay about $250 million a month in order to be able to keep up their military. So the IMF moved in and gave them a loan over, I guess it was $17 million, and organized loans from other investors amounting to about $40 billion. And these loans, once again, are tied to austerity measures that will guarantee that these loans will not be paid, because a lot of these loans are used to repay old debt with banks in the West. And these loans, of course, are tied to austerity measures, which will guarantee that it will not be the bankers that will suffer when it gets to repaying them, but that it's the common people. The common people in Ukraine, the old age pensions have been lowered there. The medical system is almost non-existent, just like Greece. You could just have to take a look at Greece and take all those measures that were implemented in Greece, and then you will know what the IMF is implementing in Ukraine at the moment. So they're creating a social catastrophe.
Yeah, the part that so many leave out is the fact that this coup that overthrew an elected government, I think it was Yanukovych, Yanukovych announced that he was going to take an $18 billion loan from Russia with no strings attached, and that's when he was overthrown. So that was the signal.
Yeah.
Yeah. He changed his mind.
You have to remember, Yanukovych was no Democrat, but actually he was elected by the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, well, we can't have that. We can't have any kind of democracy. And that's another thing that we've done over the years. So many people don't know. The same thing, I believe Iran announced that they were going to sell oil in euros also, and I think that had something to do with being on that axis of evil list that George Bush, an oil man, George Bush, created the axis of evil, and he included Iran, and so many people just went, what? Iran?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, what happens when you challenge the U.S. dollar's domination, you know?
Well, yeah, and I've actually even argued here in the U.S. with, not on the air, but, you know, privately, that people think that the U.S. dollar is going to crash. And I said, well, you know, they've murdered hundreds of thousands of at least innocent people around the world to make sure it doesn't. And that shocks a lot of people, but that's the truth. They have. And whoever they are, I don't know exactly. I mean, you know, we know they're way up there on the Forbes list of the 100 most wealthy people in the world, and probably those people that aren't on the list are part of that also.
Yeah, yeah. But the U.S. is in deep trouble at the moment because, I mean, for one thing, the U.S. dollar as reserve currency is kind of sort of fading at the moment. You see, in 2000, 80% of the world's currency reserves were held in U.S. dollars. In 2010, it was in 2000 it was 70%. In 2010, it was 60%. Right now, it's approaching 50%. And once it falls below 50%, the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency is going to be in big trouble. See, at the moment, there's a lot of rumors going on that China is waiting to make the yuan the world's leading currency, that they are backed by the Russians. And there's also a rumor that the Chinese and the Russians might get together with the Saudi Arabians and start a new currency which is backed by gold. Because the big problem of the dollar is that not only has the United States, do they have a lot of social trouble at home. I mean, there's 50 million people living on food stamps in America. The big trouble is also that the U.S. dollar is only founded on the trust of the people because it's not tied to gold anymore. So if someone else, another nation that is economically strong like China, would come up with a gold-backed currency, the U.S. dollar would be finished. And that's why the American government at the moment is very nervous, because nobody knows what's going on. The Brazilians are said to be a part of this new scheme. It is definitely possible. You can see here in Europe, you can also see that a lot of governments are moving away from the United States at the moment. Even the German government is. I mean, Germany is very dependent on Russian gas and oil. so they cannot be as aggressive towards Russia as the United States. The United States is always trying to push and to pressure Germany into more confrontation with Russia. You can see that in the Ukraine. You know, the Americans are saying, give weapons to the Ukrainians. The German government is saying no, because the German government is afraid that the Russians might stop delivering oil and gas to Germany. And Germany is also conducting a lot of trade with China these days. So actually what we're witnessing at the moment is a big move towards the east. A lot of countries are moving towards Russia and China, whereas America is fighting for the leftovers of its own hegemony.
And I'm not sure what that will do. As you say, people are slowly moving away from the dollar, and it looks like in the U.S. to me, we're creating a new Cold War, because we cannot. So much of Americans' tax dollars go to the Pentagon and into military actions, surveillance, and the NSA, and all of that that's going on around the world in order to maintain their military control. And it's having it's really hollowing out America. And we don't make anything here anymore. All we do is make deals, apparently, on Wall Street with, you know, derivatives. I mean, it's all kind of based on nothing. And so it's a scary situation around the world. And the very rich people don't really care. I think they feel like they're insulated, or they're not even aware of what the average person has to go through today, even in America. Over 50% of Americans are now living below the poverty level, the official poverty level, which is pretty low.
Yeah. Well, that's the same thing over here in Germany. I mean, everybody in America, I think a lot of people in America believe that people in Germany are a lot better off. But I live in Berlin, which has a population of 3.5 million, and of those 3.5 million, 1.2 million live in poverty. But the thing is that the mainstream media, they don't tell the people this. They keep up the illusion of a nation that lives in great wealth. But it's only about like 0.1% of people in Germany that live in real big wealth. I mean, there's about 10% of the people that live quite wealthy lives. But there's a lot of people that live in abject poverty, especially old people, and a lot of young people have big problems over here, too. But like in America, it's the mass media that tell the people that a totally different story. But this, of course, is a part of the whole thing that is going on at the moment. I mean, what we're witnessing now is that the divide, the social divide between the rich and the poor and the all over the world is widening at an incredible speed. I mean, the difference between a sun king and a pauper in the Middle Ages was nothing compared to the difference between a hedge fund manager and a social welfare recipient of today. The rich are richer than ever, and the poor, and there's more poor people than ever before.
This is what gets me. I think, and the rich must know that this is the recipe for disaster for themselves also. And I think Roosevelt, in the New Deal, he was quoted as saying that he actually saved capitalism because things were so bad here in the U.S. and the inequality was so great that people were on the verge of revolution and going towards socialism and communism. And so with the New Deal and the Second World War, America came out of that. And, of course, then we had the kind of Red Scare because we had to create a new monster in the world. We had to create the communist, and that was our new boogeyman. In America, we need boogeymen. We have to be afraid. You know, there's always somebody under the bed trying to get us. And and it's so pitiful. It's honestly pitiful. I'm an American. I'm ashamed of Americans and America, because our government is obviously out of control, murdering people around the world, drone strikes. People want to think that President Obama is somehow better than George Bush, and in reality, he's not. He just puts on a different face. You know, it's what I call Empire Light as compared to the boot in your face diplomacy of George Bush. Well, where are we headed? Where are we headed, Ernst? I mean, where are we going to where do we go from here?
We're headed for some big social conflict. That is absolutely unavoidable. Because, I mean, the divide between the rich and the poor is what fosters revolutions. I mean, take a look at the French Revolution, take a look at the Russian Revolution. Why did they happen? Because the rich were so rich and because the poor were so poor. And today, the rich are richer and the poor are poorer.
Yeah, let them eat cake, right? Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's what the hedge fund managers are telling people these days. I mean, they published a list yesterday about the 10 wealthiest hedge fund managers, and the poorest of the 10 made $1.2 billion last year. I mean, that is so sick, and the poor read that. And these days, you know, there's one big thing that the governments are very worried about. They used to influence people ideologically by television, by radio, and by the printed press. But these days, you have the social networks, and there's a lot of truth coming through the social networks. So a lot of people are more informed than they used to be. So that will, I think, that will open up a lot of people's eyes too, and people will get together. I mean, take a look at the revolution in Egypt. The social media played a very big role then in the Arab Spring. Of course, it was crushed, and it was actually crushed with the help of the Americans and with the help of the Germans also, because all the Western governments helped the Egyptian government to install the Egyptian state to install a new government then. Because before that, Mubarak had been supported by the Germans and the Americans and the whole EU over here. But these uprisings, be it in Egypt or be it in Tunisia, they saw young people organizing themselves via the social networks, and I think that will happen all over Europe, and that will also happen in America. I think you will have big social unrest in America within the next few years, because there's too many poor people that cannot live the way they're living right now. They will not be able to survive this way.
And this is the pattern, too, what we see in America. I don't know if you've heard of the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-police Gestapo tactics. We've had our military, a Freudian slip there. We've had our police force militarized, and we've wiped out all the protections for our civil liberties. We passed laws that allow the president, or not even the president, the Pentagon, to detain and imprison anybody indefinitely anywhere in the world without any due process. So this looks like where we're going, and hopefully, I'm with you. I think the youth is the answer. I mean, I'm 70, and if I could, I'd be out. Well, I am out in the streets occasionally, but I think they're going to have to get out in the streets en masse if there's going to be any change. And they have most to gain, I think.
Yep. Yeah, exactly, yes. Yes, and I think next time something big is going to happen soon. I think, take a look at the things that young people read these days. I mean, it's funny because Karl Marx is actually on the Amazon bestseller list here in Europe.
He's making a comeback.
Yeah, right. Young people are really looking for new ways, and I mean, they have been depoliticized for about 30 years over here. Because with the rise of the finance industry, along with the rise of the finance industry, we saw a depolitization of people over here. I mean, no young person these days knows anything about Marx and Engels and about socialism, but they're starting to get interested in that because they're looking for answers, and they have to look for answers because Capitalism cannot exist and much longer the way it has been existing for the past 30 years, because the financial industry has ruined everything and has driven it to the wall. And there's no way to reform capitalism anymore, because the financial industry is just sucking capitalism dry to the bone. I mean, see, we had the big crisis in 2007-2008, when all the big banks went bankrupt. And ever since, the world economy has been stagnating, and nothing has been happening since then, except for that the things have gotten worse and worse in the meantime. And it will not get better again, because nowadays the real economy is being sucked dry by the financial industry, and that will not change during the next few years. So the social conditions will go down, but I do hope that young people will wake up and that they will revolt against this.
Well, I think it's happening here, and from what I see, it's happening in Greece and other places like Spain. So if we do have a rebellion there, what is it going to look like if Greece says, you know, enough is enough, and that's it? What are they going to do to them? They're going to send in troops and go through their pockets to get the last few nickels out of their pockets? What are they going to, or drachmas, I should say, I guess?
Well, I'm afraid they're preparing for dictatorships everywhere. I mean, it's like in the 1930s, you know, before the dictatorships, you always had the national unity governments or people's fronts or so. And it looks much like that the Syriza government right now in Greece is like the last possibility to save capitalism without installing a dictatorship. So they will try to install dictatorships. But, I mean, in order to do that, they have to overcome the resistance of the people. And that resistance is growing at the moment. So it's going to be, what we're going to see is we're going to see some real, real big social conflicts. And I'm afraid we'll also see a lot of blood, a lot of bloody conflicts here. But I'm not really sure what the outcome will be, but I think that within these conflicts, the new social media will play a very big and very important role. It will not be the political parties of the past, because they have all failed. It will be new movements. I mean, they have this movement, they had the Syriza in Greece, which is, I think, is something that will pass away and that will bring up new tenure. Well, Syriza, for example, is not really a party. It's a combination of several parties. There's a communist wing to it. There's a socialist wing to it. There's a liberal wing to it. At the moment, it's the liberals that set out their policies. But they will get radicalized, and there will be new movements coming out of Syriza. And the same goes for Spain. They have this Podemos movement, mm-hmm. which is really big, and they expect them to win the elections, the next coming elections in Spain. And I think that the young people are really looking for answers, and they're getting radicalized at the moment. And I see a big chance that they might establish something like democratic socialism finally here in Europe. Because, I mean, capitalism has come to a dead end.
Well, I'm with you. I'm looking forward to some sort of revolution. We all hope that it'll be nonviolent. I don't know how realistic that is, because I don't think that these states and dictators and oligarchs that are basically running the world, I don't think that's not the option they want. They want to hold on whether it takes violence or not.
Sadly so, yeah.
Well, maybe they'll wise up. I don't know if they will. I'm afraid they won't, but I that's one of my hopes. I think Ralph Nader had a book, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, and a few years back. And I'm just wondering, you know, are the super rich going to wake up and save us and themselves?
Oh, I don't think so. No. Take a look at the politicians at the moment. I mean, all the military budgets are skyrocketing at the moment. They're really preparing for some big trouble. I mean, look at the militarization of the police in America. It doesn't look like they're looking for a peaceful solution. Look what they staged in Boston when those two young guys were chased down. I mean, those are like big military operations led by the police. And those look to me like somebody is preparing for civil war.
And they've desensitized the Americans to this by doing that sort of thing, that suspending all civil and human rights all to chase down a teenage boy, right?
Right.
It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing that Americans would even tolerate that, and that is looking more like the norm. We've been fortunate here. We have people in Oakland, and so much of this police brutality, unnecessary murders affecting minorities here, mostly black people. And that has opened a door to a lot of activism here.
Yeah. Well, it's the same over here. I mean, you might not hear about that, but they had a lot of incidents of police brutality even here in Germany. And I mean, they're having a lot of problems with the police coming down on foreigners over here. If you look like an Arab, you have a hard time getting by a policeman in Germany at the moment.
Yeah, and in France, they've taken the opportunity there to find ways to divide people and try to put in more of a police state even in France. I think that's their intention there.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So what we're seeing is a militarization of civil society. So actually, to me, that looks like these people are preparing for something that they see coming. And what anybody who knows anything about politics or about economics must see that there's big social trouble brewing because of the most important problem of our times, and that's social inequality, the explosion of social inequality. That's the main problem all over the world at the moment.
Well, we have a couple minutes, so I'm going to just let you give a little words of wisdom to the American public in a couple minutes, and then we'll have to sign off.
Okay, well, I think the most important thing today is to be informed, and not to be informed by the mass media. You have to gather your information, and you have to test your information, and you have to see what of it is true and what is not true. The mass media tell you what the ultra-rich want you to believe is true. So take a look at reality, and then you will see that we are living in a society which is driving to the edge of a cliff because of the explosion of social inequality on a world scale. And we have to stop this explosion of social inequality. We have to see to it that society goes back to the slogans of the French Revolution, which was brotherliness, equality, and liberty. And that's why I tell everybody to inform themselves, and when you have information that goes against the mainstream, tell everybody about it, tell young people about it, go onto the social networks and let other people take part in this discussion, because only that way can we change the world.
Well, we're going to have to end it there, so I want to thank you, Ernst, for being on Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling with us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's truly been a pleasure, and let me announce to the people here that they've been listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. Our guest today has been Ernst Wolf, journalist, researcher, and author. His book is entitled Pillaging the World, the History and Politics of the IMF. I will put links to his articles along with the archives of today's show on KKRN. And once again, Ernst, thank you very much for being on Unspun with us today.